Stroke Side Designs is a New York-based fine jewelry company focused on water sports. This is the best jewelry I have found through many years of searching. I love my Dragon Boat Paddle Heart earrings and my pendant. The jewelers at Stroke Side Designs have worked for famous jewelry houses such as Tiffany & Company and Cartier. All of the pieces are hand-finished from fine materials. Express your passion for kayaking, canoeing, and dragon boating. Visit paddlejewelry.com and get free shipping with the code PINK. That is paddlejewelry.com and enter the code PINK. Are you a dragon boat athlete? Have you ever thought about joining a team? Hornet Water Sports makes high-performance, lightweight, carbon fiber dragon boat paddles. You can choose from one of their many graphic designs. Don't settle for just a boring black paddle. I love their design so much that I have four different paddles. They also have all of the dragon boat accessories that you need, paddle bags, tip covers, tape, and more. Visit their website at hornetwatersports.com and enter the code PINK at checkout to receive 10% off of your order. That's hornetwatersports.com and enter the code PINK. Mary Gibson, the current president of the International Breast Cancer Paddlers Commission, joined us on the podcast today. Mary is a 30-year survivor of three different cancers. She was first diagnosed with cervical cancer, followed by ovarian cancer, and then finally breast cancer. She shared her cancer adventure, but recalls that breast cancer was the hardest. In 2006, Mary started dragon boating and became instrumental in the dragon boating community in New Zealand. In 2014, she became vice president of the IBCPC, and then in 2018 was elected president. Take a listen in as Mary shares her amazing story. Welcome to Behind the Pink Ribbon, where we share stories, information, and other content related to breast cancer. My name is Melissa Adams. I am a 12-year genetic breast cancer survivor. I've learned so much through my own journey with breast cancer. I have met some amazing people along the way, many that have become lifelong friends. I have experienced the emotional roller coaster of a breast cancer diagnosis, heartache, anger, frustration, loneliness, and even gratitude. Through this podcast, we will speak to breast cancer survivors, supporters, and healthcare professionals to gain insight and understanding behind the pink ribbon. I'm here today with Mary Gibson. She is from New Zealand, so I'm super excited to have you here. I know it's early morning where you are and mid-afternoon where I am. So welcome to the show, first of all.
Thank you. That's awesome. It's a real pleasure to be talking to you.
Absolutely. And so I want to just kind of give a little backstory on you before we actually dive into the specifics of your story. You are actually more than a 20-year survivor because you were diagnosed with cervical cancer first in 1989, followed by ovarian cancer in 1995, and then in 1999, you were diagnosed with breast cancer. So that's a lot.
It certainly is. And I guess when you're young, and young in my book anyway, young and in your 30s, it's very daunting. And I think, you know, you haven't had children yet, so you don't know where your life is going to take you. And I guess I was quite pragmatic, particularly around the ovarian and the cervical cancer. But it was the breast cancer that hit me the hardest, and probably most likely because at the time I had a young son.
Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, you were 34 when you had the cervical cancer diagnosis. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, 10 years later, here you are facing breast cancer. So let's talk a little bit. I mean, I don't even know where it is that you want to start, if you want to even address the cervical and the ovarian cancer. Obviously, the podcast is designed around breast cancer, but you know, that's part of your story. So I don't know if you want to share a little bit about those two and kind of what you went through with that and then go into the breast cancer story. So I'll let you kind of take it wherever you want.
Thanks, Melissa. Well, yeah, it was quite a shock when I was diagnosed with cervical cancer. And I think probably because I had a long history of severe endometriosis. So it sort of followed a pattern in a way. And I thought that it was the same thing. Anyway, I was very quickly in the system here in New Zealand. And at the time, there was a gynecologist by the name of Harry Bashford. And everyone knew him as Hurricane Harry. And the reason for that was because he did everything so quickly and fast. And I guess that my treatment was quick and fast. And so my natural MO at the time, I was, you know, in a career, working hard, you know, I just got on with it. I didn't think about it. I just quickly got on with it. And within a very short period of time, I met my then husband, and we were married within 3 months, and I was pregnant 3 months after that. So it was such a quick progression. And then my son was born in 1991, April of 1991. So I kind of had no time to even think about it or for it to even be an issue, really, if I'm brutally honest.
I mean, it really kind of came in like a hurricane. Sounds like everything kind of happened for you, kind of like a hurricane.
Yeah, yeah. And I still remember with great affection old Hurricane Harry. But yeah, it absolutely did. And I guess that because everything's so fast, you don't dwell on things. And that's not my nature or personality either. So it didn't seem like an issue. And when I look back, I think, oh, my gosh, I was really blasé about that. But in a lot of ways, I think that helped my recovery really quickly. And then, as I said, you know, to have my son was amazing, because I'd been told I would probably never have children, and if I did want to, I would need a lot of intervention and help. So he's quite the miracle.
Yeah. And he was born in 1991, so that was 4 years prior to then having an ovarian cancer diagnosis.
Yeah. So unfortunately, that you know, that severe endometriosis continued, and I had a lot of pain, a lot of you know, pain every time it was my menstrual cycle, and you know, so I kept visiting the doctor, and finally they found the tumor on my ovary. So they elected to remove one ovary. I thought, oh, that's good. Maybe I'll have more children, being ever the optimist. But unfortunately, I then also had a tumor on the other ovary, and that was then also removed.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, it's one of those. So I had endometriosis as well. I'm not really quite sure if the endometriosis was there and then I had my diagnosis, or because of the medication I was taking, I developed endometriosis. But it's brutal. I mean, it is genuinely brutal to have that disease. And I could see how it could easily be confused. Right? Because, you know, if you have that history of endometriosis, any pain or sensation that you're feeling that would be related to that area, I would assume that many people would just say, oh, you know, it's just endometriosis. Mm-hmm. Not just, but yeah. So
Absolutely. And the other thing is that, you know, with all due respect to the medical profession, a lot of the time when we as women have a lot of pain associated with periods, a lot of pain between periods, that I'm not sure if they think that we're, you know, basically being wimps or whatever it is, but I'm an incredibly strong person physically and emotionally. And for me to be crippled with pain, it's actually pretty serious. And as you yourself will know, and it's a very debilitating disease. And interestingly, my a gynecologist said to me, the best thing for you to do is to have a child. And well, that happened. And, you know, but it didn't fix the issue. And of course, obviously, there was a much deeper issue. So, you know, once you have those ovaries gone, you're pushed into immediate menopause, which is another exciting phase.
Yes. I can relate.
When you're young, you know, when you're young, it's like, oh my goodness. So,
yeah.
But yeah, so in between all of that, so the first ovary was removed in 95, and then the diagnosis of breast cancer. And I mean, even though they are not linked, I think there is probably some correlation somewhere along the line that the nasty little cells decide, oh, let's have a bit of a party here and we'll attack everything. You
let's
know?
Go north.
Yeah. We'll have a go, you know, why not? We're on a mission now, you know, we're on a field march. So
did they test? I mean, I'm just kind of thinking, you know, was it estrogen? You know, did they say anything about the ovarian cancer or even the cervical cancer? And I'll be very honest, I don't know a whole lot about cervical cancer, but, you know, did they say that it was estrogen related? And so, you know, thinking that, well, once it's removed, you know, everything's going to be okay.
Look, no, they didn't. And your comment about once it's removed, everything will be okay is a really interesting one because it relates to so many things. And I've had a lot of conversations with surgeons about exactly this. And I said to them, your MO, your modus operandi is to remove it and then we're okay. And that is a lot of what happens, you know, so you don't get a lot of comment around, oh, it's this or it's that, or it could be this or that, or have you checked the other or your family history? It's removed, you're fine. We got all the margins, you're okay, you know?
Right.
So I think that that was very much how it happened at that time. And my, to be honest, my gynecologist was the most beautiful, caring man. You know, he was wonderful and did everything he could for me. And you know, I have absolutely no hesitation in saying that whatsoever. It wasn't Hurricane Harry, by the way. It was a lovely man who had moved on from him, you know, because my pregnancy was considered an elderly prima gravida. Isn't that such an awesome term when you're over 35? I then went into gynecological care immediately. So, you know, look, I can't fault him for one second, and it's just how things are. And I see that so often. I see it still today. Not a lot has changed.
No.
So
you know, at this point, we're coming up on 24 years out away from your experience with ovarian cancer, and things have not progressed.
No. And I don't want to sit and criticize the medical profession at all. They only know what they know.
That's
and
it.
They don't know what they don't know. And I find, because I'm on this journey with a whole bunch of breast cancer survivors, I find I can predict a lot more simply by listening and talking and looking and seeing. And, you know, you learn the patterns, you learn what's happening. And I don't, you know, profess to be medical for one second, but I think we're really aware and really, really in tune with our bodies, but also what's happening to other people. So for me, you know, it was never a matter of woe is me or sympathy or anything like that. It was just get on with life, get on with it. You've got too much living to do. You've got this beautiful young boy now. You need to, you know, move on. And so when I was diagnosed with breast cancer, and I have to tell you, it was such a weird way that it came about. I'd, you know, a pretty healthy person, and I'd been unwell as in a cold, and then it got worse and worse and worse, and it was almost at the stage of pneumonia, and I just couldn't seem to shake it. And I went along to my GP and I said, I just can't shake this. She said, that's not like you at all. And she said, is there anything else? I said, oh, I don't know. It's just a little bit sore under my arm. I said, I don't know what that's got to do with why I can't get well. She said, you are going straight to have a mammogram. And I never for one minute thought she's crazy. What's the correlation here? There's none. Well, I can tell you, and I still say it to this day, that she probably saved my life because when I went along to have that mammogram and then to be told, hey, we need to see you again, we need to do a biopsy, and you have a 50 millimeter, so that's, you know, the size of a golf ball, 2.5 inches, tumor inside your breast, way back against the chest wall. I was like, you are kidding me. How could this happen? You know,
right.
So how could this happen from having, you know, a cold and a flu and not recovering? Wow. Unbelievable. So, you know, bit of a shock, I have to say, bit of a shock.
So were you getting mammograms before then? Because you were at the time of that diagnosis in 1999 with the breast cancer, you were 44. So, you know, I don't know what the standards are in New Zealand. You know, in the United States, we kind of go back and forth between 40 and 50. We're not really quite sure, can't make a decision. You know, so were you having mammograms at all?
Yes.
Okay.
Trying to remember it so long ago now. Well, I was 43 coming up to 44, and but they it was really, so they're free here if you're over 50, and then they keep altering the age bracket exactly as you say. And I think it's been getting younger and younger and younger all the time. So, so it was a free mammogram. So I had one previously, but it was really only, and I think because it was so deep inside the chest wall, that it was only having the biopsy that absolutely confirmed what it was. Okay. Because I had what we refer to as lumpy breasts, and what a lovely term, but you know, so I'd had that most of my adult life, so it was like, lumpy breasts, and what's the difference? And a bit of a shock.
Well, and you know, kind of an interesting point there too, in terms of, you know, thank goodness for that doctor, because, you know, had it not been for you not being able to recover well from, you know, what seemed to be a simple cold that kind of progressed, and you had gone in, you know, there might not have been the urgency in getting you seen, because if you had found this at some point in time, had an exam, it might have been equated to, you have a history of lumpy breasts, you know, which kind of does happen as well. So I'm glad that your doctor, you know, at least recognized that, you know, this isn't typical for you to not be able to shake that off and then get you in.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, and I still talk to her about that, and she's like, oh, really? You know, she's a most wonderful person, and I keep dreading the day that she retires, because we're probably of a similar age. But I do note that she only works 2 or 3 days a week now. So, you know, you really want to hang on to someone like that.
Oh, yes.
But you know, again, everything happened really fast, and it was, you know, seen by a specialist, and you need to come in next week and have a full and radical mastectomy. And I'm like, hold the bus a second here. Hold the bus a second. This doesn't work for me. It's Christmas. You know, I'm going on holiday. I need to think about this. What are my options? You know, all of that conversation that you run through in your head. And, I said, what is my window here? What's my window? And they said, if you're not here within 3 months, you're in serious trouble. And I thought, uh-oh. all right. Okay. And so I said, all right, I'll do that. And I booked the date for surgery, and it was the 14th of February. And the reason that I did that, and you'll chuckle about this, the 14th of February 2000, and I thought, I'll always remember this because it's over my heart. You know, it was my left breast. And it's over my heart. And I thought, I'll always remember the date. I like to have significant dates, you know.
Yeah.
And my surgeon went, you are crazy. And I said, nope, really important. You have to play this game with me. Well, I can tell you that, you know, we went on vacation, and some friends of ours, the male friend was a vet. And he absolutely tore strips off me. And he said, you can't do this. You need to be in hospital. You can't wait. You know, this is silly luck. And on and on. I said, look, you're a vet, not a doctor. You're a vet, you know. And he said, Mary, you are crazy. And I said, leave it to me. I know what I'm doing, you know. And for me, it was really important to have that time to process everything, because I see it so regularly how much you just drop into shock, you know, and you're like, oh, they're telling me this, I have to do this, you know. You become like an automaton almost.
You become like Hurricane Harry.
Yeah. You almost roll with the punches, but you're feeling like a punching bag, because you're just being, you know, got at from every corner. And, look, I have had a conversation not that long ago with my son. He's 28 now. And he said, and it was probably about 2 years ago, and he said to me, you know, Mum, I was really angry with you and Dad when you were diagnosed with cancer. And I said, why? Why were you angry? And he said, because you didn't tell me anything. And I said, oh, come on, surely we did. I said, you've built this into your mind that we didn't. I said, yes, we did. And he said, no, you didn't. I said, yes, we sat you down. He said, all Dad said was, Mum's got cancer. And I said, no. Do you know? And maybe that's what he heard. That's what he heard. And so he desperately needed to see his mum well. Yeah. And so I said to him in jest, well, is there anything you need to know now, you know, as an adult? He said, Mum, the internet helped me. And I thought, oh, my goodness, you know, that's just, oh, it made me feel really guilty all those years later. And I said, well, look, you know, he said, no, it's all right. It's fine. I fully understand. I said, are you sure? Do we need to sit down and have a conversation? You know, and he's like, no, Mum, it's all good now. So
thank goodness for that internet. But
yeah,
there's still some pretty scary stuff that's out there.
Yeah. But it does make you realize that not only are you in shock, but your family's in shock. The people around you are in shock, and they're processing it all in their own way.
Yes.
And I remember sitting, you know, not sitting, lying in the hospital bed, being, you know, up to my eyeballs with morphine, you know, totally la-la out of it. And hearing my visitors around me, there must have been 10 of them in the room, which, you know, sitting on the bed, sitting in the chairs, laughing and talking. And I'm lying in the bed, and this is what went through my mind. What about me? What about me? Why not listen to me? What about me? And I'm completely, you know, I'm in a morphine haze, yet that's what was going through my head. And I can still vividly remember that. So it's such a mind trip, isn't it? This whole, I don't know if it's a journey or what you want to call it. I call it an adventure, actually, because you never know what's going to come up next.
I call it a shit show because that's it. You never know what's coming next.
No, you don't. You don't. But yeah.
So did you end up opting for the radical mastectomy, or what did you decide? I mean, you gave yourself a little bit of time, which I love, because not everybody, you know, does that or is afforded that opportunity. Mm. So you did the radical mastectomy.
Yeah, I said, look, if I have the radical mastectomy, I'm not having any chemo. So it was all about bargaining for me. I negotiate a lot in business. So this was another negotiation, you know, like, I'm not having chemo if I have that, you know. So that's exactly what I did. So I had a radical mastectomy, the whole thing, and full reconstruction all at the same time.
Okay.
I thought, get it over and done with, you know, and move on. So, that's exactly what I did. And, you know, it was, for me, it was the best thing, because while you still carry a ton of doubt, it actually shifted my mind quite quickly, and I found myself in a positive space. Plus, I was, you know, working, had family, all of those things. So I moved really quickly, and, you know, other than people saying all the time, "How are you? Are you okay?" Yeah, I'm fine. I'm great. You know, because really, you feel okay afterwards. You know, and you just go through the recovery phase. It's a good 6 to 8 weeks, and then you know, you're good. You're back to it. So that was me, really. You know, moving on.
And so in that time frame, somewhere around there, you got involved with dragon boating.
Well, here's the interesting thing. The very, very last thing I wanted to do was to associate with anyone with cancer of any kind, let alone breast cancer. And I remember some people from the Cancer Society coming to see me, and I more or less said, what are you doing here? Why are you on my doorstep? You know, go away. I don't want anything to do with you. And I literally had nothing to do with anybody who had any kind of cancer for about 5 years. And I was contacted in 2006 by a very good friend of mine, and her sister lived here in Christchurch, where I was living at the time. And she said to me, you know, my friend lived in Auckland, which is where we'd met. So she said to me, my sister has been diagnosed with breast cancer. Would you mentor her? would you mentor her? Because, you know, your attitude's so great. You're five, six years down the track. You're in a really good space. And I said, sure, no problem at all. I knew her sister. I'd met her on four or five occasions. So I said, sure, happy to do that. So I did, and I, you know, chatted with her, and she mentioned doing dragon boating, and I completely dismissed it, other than to remember when I'd been in Hong Kong in the late 80s, early 90s, that I had seen dragon boating on Victoria Harbour, and thinking, oh, that's a cool, you know, that's a cool sport, that looks great. And I knew that the sport had been in New Zealand as a corporate team building sport. So that was my knowledge of it. And I thought, oh, what a dumb thing. Why is she doing that? Anyway, I kind of just let it go. And she did pass away, unfortunately. Her breast cancer metastasized very quickly to the brain. And she passed away. And I went to her funeral in September 2006. And there were these.
I mean, that was fast.
There were these women there, and they had these pink boas on around their, you know, pink feather boas. And I said to someone, oh, who are they? And they said, oh, they're the breast cancer dragon boaters. And I went, oh, you know. And anyway, a couple of them spoke at the funeral, and I thought, maybe I'll have a chat with them. So I went up and I said, oh, I'd be really interested in this. I don't know why I said that, but I said, look, I'd be really interested in that. You know, do you have an open day or something like this? Yeah, when the season starts at the beginning of November, come along, you know. And so I did, and I thought, oh, this isn't too bad, you know. And I thought I could do this, you know, the season finishes here at the end of March, and that will be me, you know, sort of 4 or 5 months, and oh, yep, that's okay. And I quite liked it and had a lot of fun. The women were great, you know. And guess what? We went to the Nationals and we won a gold medal.
Very nice.
And that was me. I'm so, you know, I'm quite competitive. Right. A gold medal, you know, at that age and stage in your life when you probably, I mean, I'd always stayed with sport, but not uber competitively. And, you know, to be involved in a sport where you could be sort of competitive, you know, at that stage in your life. And what I found really interesting was that we were given an incredible amount of respect for being out there and competing. Yeah. And I really liked that. There was the odd, you know, the sick old lady's comment, to which I wanted to slap a few people. But, you know, it wasn't a lot of people that said that. It was more respect. And you know, my conversations with my fellow paddlers was, the better we do, the harder we work, the more respect we will gain. And that's really the beginning of it. And the rest, as they say, is history. So here we are 14 years later.
You got sucked right in, just like many of us.
I absolutely went down that vortex.
Yeah, for that stupid sport.
Yeah.
That's funny. So, I mean, that really kind of led you to, I mean, you really are at this point so involved. You know, for our listeners who aren't fully aware, we just, Dr. McKenzie was on the show, and so he had shared about, you know, the creation of dragon boating within the breast cancer community for his research study. And through all of that came about this kind of governing board, which is the International Breast Cancer Paddlers Commission. And you were vice president in 2014 to 2018, and now you are president of this governing board. So from somebody who had no interest in considering that sport to now being the president of the governing board is quite the story.
Yeah, it's a really interesting one, because I, as I said, you know, I joined the sport here in Christchurch in New Zealand. And at that time, the sport was, it was, as I said, very much a a corporate sport. There were a lot of corporate entities involved, but it was starting to progress into a sport as such, as opposed to something that you did three or four times and then didn't do it again till the following year. And in 2007, in the middle of 2007, the people who had been organising the sport here in Christchurch decided that they wanted to retire. And they offered the business and boats for sale to the various teams who were located in this area. And some of our paddlers from Abreast of Life went along to the meeting and, you know, listened and came back, and they said, oh, they want to do this and they want to do that. And I said, oh, no, that's not how you do it, because my background is in business and also very strongly in governance. And so I said, no, they want to do this, and they need to set up a regional sports organization and a national sports, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, I was running at the mouth, and and they said to me, well, you better go along to the meeting. And I said, oh, no, I'm not really interested. But like that silly sport of dragon boating. Anyway, they went to another meeting and they came back and they said more things. And I'm thinking, no, this is going down a rabbit hole. This is the wrong way. And again said, no. So you better go to the meeting. So I went along to the meeting, and it was, you know, it was all these guys who had been in the sport for, like, I don't know, 15, 20 years. And I'm thinking, oh, God, I don't know anything. All I know about is structure and governance and charitable organizations and business. I know that side of things. And so, of course, you know, running at the mouth again. And and someone said, well, you better be involved in the setup and establishment. So I went, oh, God. And next thing I know, I'm the president of the Aoraki Dragon Boat Association, which is the governing body for the South Island of New Zealand. And so I was one of the inaugural founders and the founding president. So
see what happens when you talk too much.
I know, exactly. So I became very, very involved from the sports side of things, not so much from the breast cancer side. I always continued to paddle, be very much a part of our team, you know, captain of the team, all of those things, but really interested in the sport regionally, nationally, and internationally. And in 2008, we reconstituted the national body, and I became a board member of that, and subsequently the chair of that also. So I stepped down because we have a 10-year leadership role. Then you have to step down for 2 years, which I think is awesome, because it, you know, brings new blood and rejuvenates and so on. So I did that with the regional body and the national body, but also then had become very connected with the International Dragon Boat Federation. In 2000 and... gosh, might have been 13, I think, I was approached to become a board member of the International Breast Cancer Paddlers Commission. And up until that time, I just really had an arm's length view of the organisation. I'd been to the regatta in Caloundra in 2007, to the regatta in Peterborough in 2010.
Very nice.
You know, really... yeah, really lovely, but really sort of sitting back and observing and watching what was happening. And so when I was approached, I was really, we have a terminology, gobsmacked. I was just completely dumbfounded. I thought, why are they talking to me? And someone said, oh, we know that you've been awarded the President's Award for Oceania, and we know that you have a Lifetime Achievement Award in New Zealand. And so... you know, they, I guess people had seen and heard, particularly across the Tasman, which is where the nomination came from. And that's how I came to be on the board of IBCPC. And then the following year was elected vice president. And, yep, the rest then is history.
I mean, it's quite the story from, you know, again, somebody who did not really seem to have very much interest in this sport, to then come out the other side of it as being the president of the governing board for the entire world. Yeah, for breast cancer paddlers. So that's pretty cool. So, you know, there are probably many people who are listening. You know, I know that Dr. McKenzie and I talked a little bit about the IBCPC and, you know, just kind of how that all got started, and that there are still many teams that are breast cancer teams that are not necessarily underneath or, you know, kind of connected to the IBCPC. But for those that are connected, you know, tell me a little bit about what the whole role is for the IBCPC.
Okay, so IBCPC is the governing body for breast cancer paddlers around the globe, and we are an association of the International Dragon Boat Federation, which gives our member teams authenticity in terms of being able to compete at international and world events. For instance, the club cruise this year has 22 entries from breast cancer survivor teams, which is phenomenal from starting in 2014, where I think there were three or four. So we have, you know, determined what the definition of a breast cancer paddler is, and that's now enshrined in the rules for IDBF. And for IBCPC, our mission is to facilitate, or to help really promote the establishment of breast cancer dragon boat teams around the globe, you know, in a participatory fashion. First and foremost, you know, a lot of paddlers move on and they want to be more competitive, and that pathway is there, but participation is really what we are about, and developing those teams globally. I've just been in the Middle East, actually, in Egypt and in Israel, developing teams there. I am having conversations with India, you know, in countries that are really third world, that need us, that need our help, that, you know, we can help them get started, because everyone, regardless of whether they're a man or a woman, anyone who is diagnosed with breast cancer has a right to be out there paddling. There's no reason why not. And our mantra is that exercise is medicine. And it is absolutely true. You know, exercise can help so much. It helps on so many levels. There's an incredible camaraderie that develops out of being involved with a team like this, where I say this to my teammates: under normal circumstances, I might not even like half of you, let alone let alone associate with you. But here we are, and we are really good friends.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that often surprises me, because, you know, it's true. You wouldn't choose to be with some of these people, would you? You know, and you know that yourself. They always laugh at me when I say it, but I said it's absolutely true. And, you know, we went out, we were training last night, because, you know, this is the thick end of our paddling season. And I said to I'm the captain, and when the coach is away, I coach the crew as well. And I said to the ladies, you know, I'm so grateful for tonight, and thank you so much for being willing, you know, for willingly listening, for participating, for working really hard. It's so awesome. And I just said, we are so much better together. And that's really, you know, what this is all about. We are better together. And, you know, I have to say something. When I stood on the stage in Florence to give my speech at the opening ceremony, I was very emotional. And I looked out at that sea of faces, and the colour was like a field of blossoms. It was the most beautiful thing. And I thought, oh, my goodness, I'm here to look after these you know, there were about 5,000 people there, but globally we have probably up to 10,000 members. You know, it's like, wow, oh my goodness. And I'm from this little country down at the bottom of the world. How did this happen? And this is running through my mind while I'm trying to maintain my, you know, my decorum and not lose it. You know, it's just mind-boggling. It's absolutely mind-boggling. And I am incredibly grateful and humbled. Incredibly humbled. I stagger to believe it at times, actually.
Yeah. Well, I would say that they, you know, picked a great candidate to be the representative. You know, and for me and my team, we are very excited to be coming to New Zealand in 2022 for the next International Breast Cancer Peddlers Commission participatory event. So we are just, I mean, Florence was the first time that my team had ever traveled internationally. I had been at Sarasota in 2014, but 2018 was the first time for my team, and it was really big. And for many of them, it was just something that they never even imagined. And so now that we are, you know, kind of one in, we are all in.
it's so you know, it's really incredible because each festival has been so different and has opened up so many different journeys for people, adventures for people. And I just think you cannot underestimate what those festivals are. You know, they're I always laugh because they're participatory, but oh my goodness, it's so competitive.
It is very competitive.
How often did you hear, oh my God, oh, we were so, oh, and we beat so-and-so, and you're like, oh, really? Okay, it's participatory. That's good, you know. But you just go with that because that's what's important. But, you know, Melissa, the other thing that I'm really, really cognizant of is the fact that for many, many of these women and the four men who were in Florence, it could be their last adventure.
Absolutely.
And it's so important to make it really, really special and, yes, you know, to embrace everybody. It doesn't matter. And, you know, that's what I've been doing. I chaired the bid for New Zealand, and because I've always thought this is such an incredible destination, and it's a long way, but it was a long way for us to go to Florence. Everywhere's a long way.
Absolutely. And, but worth it.
You know, and I know that this is a bucket list destination for many people. Yes. And we will do it in a very Kiwi way. It won't be supersonic. You know, we're a very laid back, friendly, welcoming people. And it will be different to Florence, and it will be different to Sarasota. And I think it will be probably more aligned with Peterborough. And it will just be, let's make the most of this and come and just have a fabulous time and dance and sing and laugh and cry and all of those things. Just and paddle hard.
Yeah. Don't forget that part. And I really love that you said, I'm going to try not to get emotional here, but it's probably not going to happen. You know, for many of the people that come to the festivals, it truly could be their last because, you know, the 4 years that are in between that, I mean, things change so fast for so many people. And, I have the chills right now because we had one paddler, who she really just wanted to go to Italy, and she did. And, you know, we got her in the boat and she paddled on the first day. And then the second day she wasn't feeling well enough to paddle. And, you know, Italy was in July, and then November that year she had passed away. So, you know, when you say those words, it just speaks to me because it is the truth. And, you know, I love that you guys are taking that into consideration and recognizing that, you know, there are a lot of women and men who are part of this sport who are you know, battling metastatic breast cancer and, you know, genuinely it could be the last time that they have that opportunity to participate in something so amazing and touching and emotional and all of those other things that I don't have right now to describe it. You know, in that kind of event. So, you know, I thank you for saying that because I think that's important. And it is competitive. My first team, which is Pink Steel out of Pittsburgh, we, you know, brag a lot about taking second place in the world and first place in the United States in Sarasota. So it is competitive, but I do genuinely love that, you know, it is really a place for everybody to come and have a seat in the boat.
Look, Melissa, I am, you know, totally with you, and we can all share exactly that same story. And we you know, my own team, before we left, three of our young ones in their 40s were all diagnosed metastatic, and one of our 65-year-olds also diagnosed metastatic, and of those four, had all been working hard and fundraising and wanting to be in Florence. Only one went. Carlene passed away in April before we went. And Lou, who came with us, had just passed away in January. You know, Jill is now, so we will be three in 2 years. And in my spare time, if I ever have any, I'm a marriage celebrant also. Carlene asked me if I would conduct her funeral. And I was dumbfounded. And she said to me, and this was 2 days before she slipped into a coma, she said to me, "I've never seen you at a loss for words. Come on, you're doing this." And I went, you know, like I was just choking. And I said, and I knew I had to. I knew I had to for her because the team had become her life, you know, after her family, of course. And I knew I had to do that. And wow, what an honor that was. What an honor. And, you know, but what I found was I had to separate myself from my team because otherwise I would have just been a bawling mess. But to you know, and I just said to the girls, "I'm not ignoring you. It's not that I don't like you or don't want to be with you. I just need to contain myself and wrap myself in a bubble here to be able to do this." Yeah. And, you know, and then before Lou passed, she, and you may have seen the post that we put up on Facebook because she had a blog that everyone around the world followed and they were all asking about her. So put up a lovely little piece of video footage. And Lou asked me the same thing and I went, "Oh God, you know, no." But you know how important it is, exactly what I'm saying about the festival. It's exactly the same importance about knowing that you have, you know, you're walking in the shoes of someone at a much higher power and you absolutely have to do it. It's what it's about. And I guess that's my realization. And I remember walking on the beach in Brazil where we were at an outreach clinic and Dr. Don was walking beside me and I said to him, "Oh my goodness, I feel like a rock star." He said, Mary, you are a rock star. And I went, "Oh." And then I said, "I feel like we're doing God's work." He said, "Mary, we are." And I thought, "Oh my goodness, this is, you know, this is what it's about." That was back in October 2016. And I just, yeah, that's what it's about. And you know, it's so humbling, isn't it, to be on this journey, to be, an adventure. I don't like the word journey. It makes sound like there's a destination. There isn't. It's an adventure. Yeah. And we're traveling it with really good mates. And that's so important, so special.
Yeah. Well, and I would agree. You know, I think that it is really important to have people like you who are leading the charge in whatever fashion, in whatever way that is impacting the lives of so many people. You know, and I know that forever the team that went to Italy, they will forever be changed through that experience. And so many have said that to me. You know, so thank you so much for, you know, doing the work that you're doing. I'm sure that it's not an easy task. you know, but it is great work and it's important. So, you know, from one peddler to another, from a coach to a captain, and just, you know, a breast cancer survivor to breast cancer survivor, thank you so much, genuinely, for all of the work that you're doing.
Oh, thank you, Melissa. And you said the words that I always say, I'm just a peddler. I'm just a peddler. And that to me is what I'll always be. And people often say to me, oh, you peddle. And I went, yes. You know,
as do that too.
Surprise. Yes. That's the biggest pleasure, being out there paddling, being just a paddler.
Absolutely. Well, I want to thank you so much. We have spent so much time together. This may genuinely be my longest episode, but I loved it. And again, I told you at the beginning, I just may let you continue talking because I love to hear your voice. but thank you again for spending your morning with us and for sharing your story and, you know, just sharing everything about dragon boating and all of the work that you're doing.
Thank you. And thank you for the opportunity. And I just want to pass my my love and blessings to all of your listeners. And, you know, thanks and keep paddling.
Yeah. Thank you for listening to this episode of Behind the Pink Ribbon. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. If you or anyone you know would be interested in sharing your story, please send an email to podcast@behindthepinkribbon.com.
Thinking about advertising on this podcast? Our ads not only create awareness for your brand, but also contribute to the continued growth and support of this show. Email us today and be on our next episode. Email podcast@behindthepinkribbon.com for more information.
You've been listening to Behind the Pink Ribbon, produced by American Creative Consulting. Mixed and mastered at Riverview Podcasting Studios. For more information, please visit designbyacc.com.